Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
Hi, folks. This is the Pro Wrestling Roundtable. I am John Morgan Neal, your host, and we will be talking today. It's going to be a bit of a bittersweet episode in a way, because for one thing, this is our 50th anniversary, our 50th episode, which is a 50th anniversary, so whatever. Anniversary doesn't have to be yearly, I guess, but maybe it does. I digress. Anyway, this is our 50th episode, which is cause for celebration, but we have decided to dedicate a large portion of this program to the memory of Gregory. He's still alive, Mark Calloway is, but The Undertaker is quite dead, it seems like. And we decided we would turn this to a retrospective and talk about The Undertaker and our memories of The Undertaker and so on and so forth. Some other extra bits as usual. And as always, I'm joined by our wonderful producer, the wonderful Richard Yule. And Jonathan Williams, our bon vivant man at large. And tonight we have a newcomer to our show, a friend of Richard, Carson Hunt. So sit back and give a listen and, rest in peace.
Previously on Podcasterole.
Glomer is one of the most underrated cartoon characters of all time.
Some call Glomer the Jar Jar of the PBU, you know. I haven't stepped foot inside of a Subway since, really.
And neither is Jared.
It's true.
You're over at my home every week. Is there a meth lab here?
Not a big one.
I choose him, the one called Kirk. I'm freaking James D. Kirk.
Find out more about Podcasterole now on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and Google Play. And don't forget AdamandJP.com and the ESO Network.
All right, baby, Andre, my man. How are them butterflies spinning around in that belly welly of yours, waiting for them pretty ladies to get here?
Pretty butterflies.
Excuse me, are you gentlemen ready to order? Daddy, we're waiting for our dates to arrive.
I would like ribs.
Well, maybe get the big fella here a snack while we wait. Well, of course, sir. Oh, I'm so excited a hard-working man such as myself was able to put this date together.
I'm so excited. I just can't hold it.
Well, there's no hiding from the fabulous Moolah. Oh, and they're fabulously old, May Young. And here are your ribs, sir.
I want my baby back.
All right, Dad, enough of this silliness. Here they come now. Well, hello there, gentlemen. Are these seats taken? Why, no, Fabulous Moolah, they certainly are not. You're damn right they're not. And women get tired, especially after being slammed to the table off the stage by a camouflage-wearing crazy man. Now, me, that was a long time ago.
And at my age, everything was a long time ago.
Well, Miss Young, you don't look for a day over 60. Excuse me, what can I get everybody to drink? How a sweet tea, baby!
What, Steve Weiser?
I would like a water, please.
I want something wet and strong so I can wrestle them Dudleys and make it back to me with a big boy here.
That's my kind of woman.
Hi, big fella. Looks like you made a good impression on this lady. Excuse me, here are your drinks, and our drinks, sir. You're all ready to order, sirs and madams.
Oh, why, yes, sir. I like that sweet fried chicken with a side of squash.
And for you, sir?
Whatever, sir.
And how about for you, lovely ladies? A salad, please.
I want a steak with a touch of brown and still moving.
A few minutes later.
Oh, Daddy, that dinner was delicious.
Yum, yum, yum.
That was absolutely exquisite.
I can feel that thing moving in my belly. It was brown to perfection, Moolah.
Well, me, sweet me, Young, tell that big fella here something about your past. Let's get to know each other.
Well, there's not much to tell, other than the fact I once gave birth to a hand.
Check, please.
10, 9, 8.
The White Rocket Podcast, hosted by Van Allen Plexico, covering the entire universe of popular culture, movies, TV, books, comics, music, and more, with interviews, convention panels, discussions about current and classical works, and much more. The White Rocket Podcast, it's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture.
For the Pro Wrestling Roundtables, a 50th episode, we proudly present Andre the Giant and Mae Young.
Baby, when I met you, that was perfect. I should have got the weather far too calm. I was off that side. There was something going on. You did something to me that I can't explain. I'm a closer to feel pain. Every beat of my heart. Well, there's something going on. Tender love is blood. It requires a dedication.
All this love we feel needs no conversation. We riot together. Ha ha. Making love with each other. Ha ha.
I enjoy the stream. That is what we are. No one in between. How can we be wrong? Sail away with me to another world. And we rely on each other. From one level to another.
I can't live without you if the love was gone. Everything is nothing if you got no one. And you did walk in the night, slowly losing sight of the real thing. But that won't happen to us, Andre. We got no doubt. Too deep in love and we got no way out. And the message is clear, Andre. There's gonna be the year for the real thing. No more will you cry. Baby, I will hurt you never, probably. We started in this one, in love forever. We can ride it together. Ah! Make it love with each other. Ah!
This is the stream. That is what we are. No one in between. How can we be wrong? Sail away with me to another world. And we rely on each other. From one lover to another. Sail away.
Oh, come sail away with me.
That is what we are.
Now I am betrayed.
How can we be wrong?
Sail away with me.
To another world.
And we rely on each other. One lover to another.
I lose in the stream. That is what we are. No one in between. How can we be wrong? Sail away with me to another world. Are we without each other? I'm not certain. I'm very comfortable with this.
Hey, folks. This is the Pro Wrestling Roundtable, and there's Bones. And as I said earlier, we're going to talk about The Undertaker. But first, I'm going to start a new little tradition here on our wonderful roundtable, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this day in history. Obviously, we only record every couple weeks or so, and so we're not going to talk about like the entire month. We're just talking about the day. But there was a couple of particularly good ones, and if there usually some days there may not be any, so we not, I'll do this every single time. But this day we actually had a couple of interesting historical moments that were significant. First of all, 60 years ago, we had what is reportedly, very possibly, very likely, the very first female wrestling tag team match. All right, 60 years ago in St. Louis, Missouri, June Byers and Penny Banner, who had a very extended feud for years with the respective partners of China Myra and Bonnie Watson, took place. I mean, did the first women's tag team match. So that's pretty nifty, I think. Especially considering that this show actually had a three-part episode talking about women's wrestling. Yeah, we are definitely a proponent of the women's wrestling situation. 30 years ago today, I'm skipped. 36 years ago today, in Augusta, Georgia, Wildfire Tommy Rich defeated Harley Race to win the NWA World Heavyweight Championship, which was a very big surprise to everyone. It was not an expected thing. It was a power move by the Georgia office to gain power. He only held it for 4 days, and some people have sort of poo-pooed that, but you know what? There's a lot of wrestlers that have never been NWA World Heavyweight Champion. So Tommy Rich has got that on his resume for the rest of his life. So, and well, beyond his life. So that's a pretty cool thing. And then 6 years later, he took place in one of the hottest, huge feud angles in Memphis history. When Austin Idol was in a cage match against Jerry Lawler, a hair versus hair steel cage match for the AWA Southern Heavyweight Championship. Paul E. Dangerously was Austin Idol's manager. That was really his first gig, really put him on the map. But Tommy Rich was under the ring. He actually literally was under the ring the whole day with a six-pack of beer and an air mattress. And he emerged and put the pile driver on Lawler, and then they did a spike pile driver, and then they crotched him on the ring post and shaved his head. And, of course, Memphis fans were going out of their minds and were attacking the cage and pretty wild stuff. So, and this also was 18 years ago when WWF taped the pilot episode of SmackDown in New Haven Coliseum in New Haven, Connecticut.
Oh, wow.
And as it actually originally was going to be just a one-off special, but it scored a 5.8 rating, and UPN obviously said, hey, we'll do some more of these. So the show was launched and still here. And so there you go. That is the history in professional wrestling right now. Oh, and Vern Gagne died this day a couple of years ago. And that's a sad thing. So I'm not going to talk about that one. So anyway, there you go. Anybody got any thoughts before we move on?
I don't, other than the fact that I always thought it was weird that it was called SmackDown because that was The Rock's catchphrase, or part of The Rock's catchphrase.
And he totally marketed that, too, by saying it was The Rock Show.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, you know, SmackDown garnered, and rightfully so, the reputation as being the B show. Very much the B show, and definitely turned into a B show, but it didn't start out that way, and it didn't do that. It didn't turn into the B show very quickly. Now it may be in Vince's mind, it certainly was, but the people that were working on it certainly did not think that way, and they did their damnedest to make the show very entertaining. And there was a long while there where I preferred SmackDown on Raw over Raw. I actually right now prefer it over Raw, but. There were, but they finally did kill it, or whoever, Dunn or Vince or whoever. And for a while there, SmackDown was nothing. It was just basically a repeat of Raw. But I'm happy that SmackDown has emerged again, because I don't know if maybe it's because it's kind of away from Vince's, you know, Iron Fist or whatever. But it's just whenever people are actually putting some effort into it, it just always seems to be a little better to me than Raw, because Raw has got the whole big thing about it, you know.
Yeah, back in the mid-2000s, when Heyman and Stephanie were basically booking it, yeah, it was the best.
It was. So, anyway, all right. So.
Richard here. I really hope you're enjoying this episode. It's a big one for us, and hope you enjoyed the comedy that we had at the beginning by the wonderful Joe Crow. I wanted to take an opportunity to tell you about Patreon. That's right, we have a Patreon account that you can support monetarily if you so choose. We already appreciate everything you guys do, the shares and such, but if you would like to contribute more to get more, we have that opportunity for you. All you have to do is go to www.patreon.com/theprowrestlingroundtable, and for as little as $5, you can get things. You can get, we offer more podcasts, we offer, you know, trading cards, one of a kind, drawn by Brian Silverbacks. So go over there and check it out, and now back to the show.
Even this, as I mentioned in our intro, this is our 50th episode, so it calls for celebration, and you know, we got a part, we're all wearing party hats and we're eating cake virtually. So that's all like woohoo, yay, celebration. But for some reason we've decided to take our celebration and turn it into a remembrance of the dear departed and Undertaker. Mark Calloway's fine and good, but Mark, the Undertaker apparently is dead, and we're going to do a career retrospective and share our memories and thoughts about arguably the greatest professional wrestler or sports entertainer or whatever word you want to use that WWE has ever produced. So there we go. We're going to talk about the Undertaker. Before I go into, I guess, his Yeah, let's go ahead. Mark Calloway was born in Houston, Texas. I don't even knew this. He was born on March 24th, 1965, which I was born on March 20th, 1963. So that's pretty cool, I think. I mean, it may not be cool to y'all because y'all weren't born then, but cool to me. So, anyway, he went to school like everybody does and was a basketball player, got a basketball scholarship, went to Texas Wesleyan University in Fort Worth, which is pretty near me. It's just like 2 hours away from me. And he also majored in sports management. And he dropped out of university with a focus on career in sports. Briefly considered playing in basketball in Europe. Then he decided, hey, I want to be a professional wrestler. And the reason I believe that The Undertaker became who he was and became one of the greatest wrestlers to ever wrestle in this industry is because he found the right trainer. He found Don Jardine, which was the legendary Spoiler. And I know that the Spoiler's a little before you guys' time, and he's even a little bit before my time, but I got the tail end of his career. He wrestled in Texas quite a bit, wrestled all over the world, though, in Japan, everywhere else. He was one of the greatest villains in wrestling history. He had a style all to his own. He had a presence all to his own. He created the whole walking the ropes. He did all that stuff. So he trained, his training, Mark Calloway, you know, us people who knew the Spoiler, we see the Spoiler in The Undertaker. But not that he's just a copy. He took what the Undertaker, what the Spoiler did, and the things that the Spoiler taught him, and he made his own way. And when he finally found the perfect gimmick for himself and ran with it as the longest run that, you know, that most any professional wrestler has as a particular gimmick. But that was all because Don Jardine. He actually taught him how to do it right, his way, so that allowed Mark to be different as well. And because he wasn't just another big guy, he wasn't just, you know, another, you know, just another guy. Undertaker is truly unique, and not just in, you know, the drapery of the costume or the entrance or the but we're talking about the way that the Undertaker, how Mark carried himself and the style he had in the ring and all of that and the other. All that, I mean, that just created the depth of the character. So it all began with his training with the right guy. He actually debuted in 1984 for World Class Championship Wrestling. I was there. I mean, not there live, but I was watching it. He was first called Texas Red, and his first match was a loss against Bruiser Brody, which is a pretty good deal. I mean, Bruiser was one of the biggest stars in the business. And it wasn't a squash job. You know, he was introduced as a threat, and Bruiser won, but Texas Red was this big villain to possibly challenge Bruiser. And he went through a couple of different, several different gimmick changes, trying to find something that would stick. He went to Memphis, the Continental Wrestling Association. Then he was managed by Dutch Mantel. And he was the Master of Pain, a character supposedly out of the United States Penitentiary in Atlanta for killing two men in a fight. So he actually challenged Jerry Lawler for the USWA Unified World Heavyweight Champion and actually easily dominated Lawler. And he actually they turned into a program where he actually ended up winning the title, and then Phil Lawler got it back. So, I mean, really, he started out, you know, in his first 4 years in these mass characters and these gimmicks and so forth, he was actually working on the top of the card or in major things. He wasn't just, you know, a jobber or undercard guy. So already, you know, he had the goods. And then he went to back to Texas after it had become WCWA, and he won the Texas Heavyweight Championship there as the Punisher. And I actually saw him live as the Punisher here in my hometown of Sherman, Texas. He wrestles as the Punisher where they were had set up a show at the Texas Guard Armory. And he was the Punisher, and he was facing Kevin Von Erich. So, again, top-ranked guy. It was a great match. Kevin won, but it was a, you know, a great match. So, and then in 1989, he went to World Championship Wrestling, and he adopted the ring name, got rid of the mask. He didn't wear a mask anymore, and he became Mean Mark Callis. Which actually, apparently, Terry Funk came up with that name. He was portrayed as a morbid character. He wore predominantly black ring attire and was described by announcer Jim Ross as having fondness for pet snakes and the music of Ozzy Osbourne. Oh, my God.
The horror.
What a horrible person. He quickly was drafted into the Skyscrapers after Sid Vicious got injured. Sid Vicious never gets injured. And... which is a shame, because the Skyscrapers, I thought, was a gimmick that could have. It was actually pretty over, but with Sid getting injured and then some other stuff going on, it was just Mark was came in too late and it didn't work. And it had something to do. There was just a bunch of back. Well, there was WCW had lots of problems back then with Jim, with Herd. So anyway, kind of works with Paulie Dangerously a little bit, and it's just not working. He's not, it's just not going. Still working, you know, in not main event situation, but, you know, not on the lower, I mean, not jerking the curtain or nothing. But anyway, he apparently decides that isn't working. He gets pulled over to WWF. I'm pretty sure Jim Ross was behind that. And it just so happens that there was this gimmick that Vince and Patterson and them had come up with about a Western mortician. And so finally, Mark came along at the right time, at the right place. They put this gimmick on him, debuted at the Survivor Series as the mystery partner of Ted DiBiase's Million Dollar Team, came in and dominated, and Paul Bearer was his original manager, Brother Love was his original manager, but then finally everything come together and click whenever Percy Pringle as Paul Bearer with his stronic and ghostly manner, carrying the urn, put the whole thing way over, and the Undertaker was born, and the rest is history.
Percy was an actual mortician, too.
He was, that's right. Yes, he was.
And that's one of the reasons he got the job. Like they,
it was basically an interview. He mentioned it to Vince, and God damn it, that's perfect.
Was the Undertaker part of the occupation phase of WWF?
Obviously must be. Think about it. It's the right time, and then he's an Undertaker, and they're, you know, and a mortician. So, yeah, sure. It just goes to show that sometimes, you know, even in the silliest things can take off and make a life of their own. So, and it depends on the people involved, so. So, the Undertaker was a occupation. So anyway, I guess we're going to go around the table here, and I'm going to get everybody's, you know, just some general thoughts about the Undertaker. So we'll start with our newbie, Carson.
Oh, man, spotlight's on me already, right?
Yeah. And throw you right out there.
Yeah, well, with me and The Undertaker, my earliest memories have to be of, what was the name of the Saturday morning show that would come on that would highlight what happened on wrestling that week or whatever pay-per-view was on? Do y'all remember that?
Superstars.
Yeah. Superstars, that's it. Okay, so that was my first introduction to The Undertaker. And
That was his original debut, so I did neglect to mention that.
Survivor Series.
His wrestling debut was at Survivor Series, but his on-television debut was on Superstars.
I remember seeing him on the recap of the Survivor Series pay-per-view.
Right.
And I never saw pay-per-views back then. It was just way too expensive. My family was not interested in wrestling, and so I never got them. So I was always really interested to see what happened, you know, a week before, you know, at the pay-per-view,
right,
on Superstars. And so, yeah, when The Undertaker came out, that was the buzz of everybody at school was like, have you seen this new wrestler? And I also used to get the WWF magazine. And of course, they had a big, huge write up about him and really hyping his character quite a bit. So I think this, you know, that
Vince Russo, thank you.
Yeah. I bet. And so, you know, that was kind of one of those things where it was during the days of kayfabe was still pretty heavy during that time. And so much mystery surrounding this character of, you know, who is he? Who is he really? Is he really from Death Valley? And so he just, you know, and that just added to the mystique as him being shrouded in mystery like that.
Well, indeed, actually, real quick, I'll say, I think the reason why the character lasted so long and remained successful is because he's one of the few people that really kept kayfabe quite a bit with his character.
Right, right.
I think that wasn't any accident to that.
So that was my first memory of him. The biggest memory I have, though, is when I did get to see him live. I was ringside at a SmackDown house show, and that was in the early 2000s. So that means that there was probably about three people that anybody would be interested in seeing at a SmackDown house show. But thankfully, the main event was Undertaker versus the late, great Eddie Guerrero.
Oh, and, wow.
The action spilled out into out of the ring and into the crowds, and they got up pretty close to me, and I was just amazed at how incredibly huge the Undertaker was. I was just... He didn't look like he belonged on this planet. It's like he looked like a superhero, you know. He's just so huge. I remember that, and I also remember all the hype around the introduction of Kane, and this is his brother, and it's just kind of funny the things that we remember and the things that stuck. That's harder to do nowadays, you know. The mystery of wrestling and I just don't think that a character like Undertaker could ever exist in the same way anymore because of the internet, because of how transparent the business is. I mean, honestly, even stars like Bray Wyatt, who is probably the closest thing that we have right now to the Undertaker as far as a dark, mysterious gimmick. I mean, he's still not all that mysterious. I mean, you know, he's on Instagram posting pictures of, you know, him having a good time with whoever. And it's,
yeah, you know, he's pretty good about being... you know, staying in character and keeping kayfabe, but he there are those moments like that where he lets it slip. And if he wouldn't do that, and if they really would push that character as a dangerous and successful wrestler, I think he could do it. And, you know, it's again one of those things. I'm not going to say that he has, you know, nobody's the Undertaker and nobody's going to totally replace him. But
And I'm not even saying that he should go down that route. It's a very, very different time. And you know, there's going to be so much nostalgia that we have that carrying on with an Undertaker that the new generation is looking at an Undertaker and going, just old guy, you know. Yeah. They don't have that same nostalgia. But yeah, he was always one of my favorites. And of course, I don't know how much I want to get into it right now because I don't know where all the conversation is going at the moment. But
Well, I'll come back to actual particular memories in a minute.
Okay.
I just want to get a general
overview,
whatever. But you did say something that prompted me to ask this, though, real quick.
Yeah.
So you said you saw him live. I saw him live at our live Raw and a house show. And have Jonathan, did you ever see him live? Richard, have you seen him live?
Yeah, I've seen him a few times. I'm trying to remember the... This may not be the actual first time, but the first time I remember, it was a SmackDown taping in Duluth at the arena just north of Atlanta, and it was when he was feuding with Randy Orton, and it wasn't as apparent live as it was when I went back and watched that same episode that I recorded, but he made lightning strike the stage.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff. You know, that was when eventually Randy Orton put him in a coffin and caught it on fire.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And all that stuff was going on with. And then Cowboy Bob Orton was involved with it as well.
Oh, yes. Yep.
But I saw.
Until he discovered he had some health issues that nobody needed to be around him if he bled. That's the layer. Go ahead.
But I saw the his match with he had two in a row with Triple H at WrestleMania in Atlanta and then the next year in Miami.
Yep.
And really I feel like that one in Miami was the last really good match that he had.
And that's probably fair to say, I think. Yeah. The Punk match was pretty good, but I think that might be his real true last great match, if I was to say so. Yeah. Richard, did you ever see him live?
Well, I wasn't done.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were. My bad. I'm a horrible human being. Go right ahead.
Well, you said it, not me.
I know.
No, I mean, I've seen him. I've seen him at, you know, various Raws and SmackDowns in Atlanta, but I guess the last time was when Survivor Series was here. And it was his anniversary of his debut, which was two Survivor Series ago. And it was him and Kane against the Wyatts. And I was lucky enough to be right behind the commentators. So when Braun Strowman got put through a table and all that kind of stuff, it was right in front of me. Like,
that's cool.
But unfortunately, Undertaker never came over there. Everybody else came to right where I was, but he kind of stayed in the ring or on the other sides of the ring. So I've never really been up close enough to him to get the experience that that you just talked about.
I started to think that show at Survivor Series may have been his last, as much as they were pushing the 25-year promotion.
Yeah, me too. Or I thought maybe the next WrestleMania would be his last one, because wasn't that the one that was in Texas?
That's right. Yes. That's right. I thought that as well.
Dallas.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's it for me, Richard.
Well, I've seen him live probably a few times in the late 90s. I went to wrestling quite a bit. But one that stands out in particular was when him and Kane were the Brothers of Destruction, and I think he came back somehow, because like Kane was getting beat up and then Undertaker come out. But that was kind of a time where people were kind of getting burned out on it, and so a lot of people were, it was a Monday Night Raw, and people were getting kind of burned out on just, like, it was always the Undertaker and Kane at the end, it seemed like, or it was always, you know, nothing really important happened, like, no new people showed up. Might have been closer to early 2000s, but people actually started leaving, and, like, before the thing was over, and so that's kind of the only memory I have of, like, a live thing, but, I mean, I've always been a fan of them, but never... I probably have more memories of Kane than I do The Undertaker. Yeah. Which, enough, Kane was actually his name.
Yes, he was.
He was Kane the Undertaker.
Yep, he introduces Kane the Undertaker on Superstars. Yes, he was.
And then by the time he hit Survivor Series, they just dropped the Kane.
They dropped the Kane, yeah. Anyway, I thank you for the reminiscences, everybody. But you know, what I was really kind of aiming for here was to make sure that we all had that experience. And so are we all in agreement, like us wrestling in general, and WWE maybe even in particular, are subject to hyperbole? I think we could all agree, since we've all experienced it, that one thing that is not hyperbole is what that entrance is like in person.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And
I think that's probably the gold standard of entrances for any WWE star. Everybody, you got the chills when you heard the gong sound. And there's few entrances that capture the emotions of the crowd quite like the Undertaker's.
Yeah, it's the greatest entrance, period. I mean, and I've got a lot of them that I like quite a bit, but I can't think of anything better than the Undertaker's. It's iconic, and I always liked it, but when I saw it live, and and Jim Ross and them always said, what it feels like, and I just thought it was more, hype or whatever. But I felt it, man. I felt every bit of it.
Oh, for sure.
It was like okay, there. Jim wasn't lying to me.
That was the same feeling even at a house show when you didn't have all the pomp and circumstance.
Yeah, the first time I saw was the house show. It was actually great. It was a great house show because it was in the main event, and he was wrestling Bret Hart. So and all of the Hart Foundation were there. So I mean, I got to see, Davey Boy and Owen and Bret and Pillman and Neidhart were all there, and of course he ended up interfering, But
I am glad, though, that they decided to have the Undertaker appear halfway up the entrance way on this past WrestleMania, or he would have never gotten to the ring.
Sadly, no.
Yeah, that reminds me. I think it was when WrestleMania was in Atlanta, or maybe in Miami. I don't remember which one, but I went to the WrestleMania Access, and one of the things they had that you could do was you could pick from, I think, 5 or 10 wrestlers, and then do their entrance. And there was like a little miniature entrance ramp set up, and they had Edge and, a bunch of people, but the Undertaker was one of them, and nobody did that one because it would take 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You get like a little card where you could go and download it later and whatever. And I thought about doing it, but I was just like, no, I got better things to do with my 10 minutes today.
Could be worse. Could be Randy Orton.
Yeah. With a giant sperm cell.
Yeah.
I guess that hadn't happened yet.
No. I just, but well, at least that, I am very old and addle brain. Quiet, Jonathan. Because I sit there, I actually have seen The Undertaker live 3 times. The latest one was last year at WrestleMania. It was like the one to forget is like the most recent one in like at freaking WrestleMania. So anyway, there we go there. The Undertaker had an amazing career. Was always a special event or main event wrestler. Obviously, is Mr. WrestleMania in the fact that he's, I know Shawn Michaels has that nickname, but I think I called it different, but I don't remember. But anyway, I mean, nobody's more associated with WrestleMania now than Undertaker is. No one's had to run at WrestleMania like Undertaker has. And I mean, I'm not even just talking about the streak. I'm talking about the fact that he actually had a career that was allowed him to appear all those times in a row. I think he missed one.
Yeah, he did.
Yes, he got one. But that's amazing. It really is amazing.
Well, it's also a testament to him as a wrestler, because the WWE would not have allowed him to continue that streak if he wasn't performing the way that he was.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and the fact that he's a company man, somebody that is reliable, somebody that Vince has relied on and trusts, and is a leader, a true leader in the back, you know, with the boys in the back, and he's just, you know, in everybody that you ever hear any shoot interviews, you hear any, you know, interviews with guys or whatever the business who used to work there or work there now, or, you know, legends, have nothing but respect for the guy. I mean, they all have nothing but great things to say about the guy. Ric Flair, you know, worships the man, you know. He's a truly phenomenal individual. He truly is a phenom, because not only that, but because his physicality. I mean, he way beyond what you would expect. I mean, of course, originally he was booked to be the big, slow, plodding big guy, and a lot of people thought that that's all he could do. I knew different, because I'd seen him, you know, wrestling there in Texas and Memphis, and knew that he could do a lot of things, but he wasn't meant to be as the Undertaker originally, but eventually he was allowed to do that, and he showed that he was incredible speed and agility for a big guy, and doing all those bumps, doing that suicide freaking dive, doing all this, that, and the other, and just now retiring. You know, yeah. I mean, a big body takes damage a lot worse than little ones do.
Absolutely.
And for the fact that he's been able to carve out this incredible legacy, I don't see any wrestler ever been able to do it or top it. It's just, he is truly remarkable.
And for all the greatness that he is, I think the greatest thing he did was overcome a kind of really bad start. As far as some of his big matches, you know, he was kind of up against a wall, sort of. I mean, his big feuds were Giant Gonzalez, which, yeah, terrible. I mean, just awful. And then they did the Undertaker versus Undertaker, which was a cool idea, but it was just not executed all that great.
Unfortunately, that the person that hurt worse than anybody is Brian Lee.
Yes,
who should have been a big star, should have been a huge star, but he never did make it on the big stage in a big way. So, but yeah, you're right. I mean, he was up against the wall on a lot of things. I mean, the booking was just terrible in the early 90s anyway, or mid-90s, before, I mean, what to get the new generation or whatever it was. Before it got better before the actual Attitude Era started, but it got really good there, actually, right before what usually people say is the start of the Attitude Era, with the stuff of Heart Foundation and DX starting and so on and so forth. But
of course, with the Attitude Era, you have the horrible storyline, in my opinion, of the stealing of Stephanie McMahon, yes, and the crucifixion of Stone, yes, Cold.
That was not the best run for Undertaker, no. By the way, I just heard something, and I don't know if it's the truth or not. I mean, Kevin Nash is the one that said it, and Kevin has a reputation, at least since, I'm not going to say he's got a reputation as a liar, he's got a reputation that other people disagree with some of the things that he has said. Because, I mean, whether he was, and the reason I say that is, because it's just fresh in my mind, because I just rewatched it the other day, where apparently Kevin, when he was in London a few years ago doing stuff for WrestleTalk TV, he was in an interview and he said that he believed that the Montreal Screwjob was a work. And then they asked Jim Cornette about it, and Jim said that he's either stupid or he's lying or he's just trying to stir the pot or whatever. He knows better than that. But that's the reason why I say, because you never know what Kevin. But Kevin said in a interview at some point, and I think it's been more recent, he said that there was a move to get Undertaker to switch over to WCW. And there was a potential chance of it happening, at least in so much in that he knew how he was going to appear, because he couldn't be the Undertaker, because that's all sewed up and owned by WWE. So he would have to come in as a sort of a new character. And the character, supposedly, according to Kevin, was going to be a biker, you know, thing, with his, because his own interest in biking and so on and so forth, and this big, tough biker, tough guy. And he says that he believes that coincides with when he decided to become, you know, the biker character, Undertaker biker character. So, if you take that with a big grain of salt, it's what Kevin Nash says. You take it as you want. But that was the one of the impetus for him to switch his character at that time, because it was actually something he considered doing for WCW.
Well, you got to give him credit, too, in the sense that, looking back now, that was... I mean, that was really, really far removed from his gimmick that he had and that he ended with. But looking back on it now, it's a pretty silly gimmick. But at the time, I don't know anybody that came out on a motorcycle and ran around the ring and people thought it was pretty darn cool at the time.
Well, there's two things, I think, that made it work and why Taker did it. One is the ministry thing, which I think he felt hurting, and I think it did. And two, the old school Undertaker guy just really didn't fit the whole new attitude thing quite as well. So being a big, tough biker, badass, you know, I'm the big dog, this is my yard, riding a motorcycle around, that fit the attitude era perfectly.
And the introduction of a new finisher.
Correct. So, again, the great ones adapt. The great ones are able to survive and make themselves still relevant in whatever changes there are in the business. And Taker certainly did that. And then when that run its course, he knew it was time to bring back everybody was ready for the Undertaker to come back. He did. Everybody was happy. And so there you go.
How did you all feel about his departure on this past WrestleMania?
I'm a big fan of The Undertaker, but I guess I said, I mean, I've been just, you know, raving about him this whole time, so that's not a secret, but I just have this deep abiding respect for him. I mean, there's a lot of guys in the business that I'm a big fan of, but I don't necessarily have that kind of respect for. Not that I disrespect them, I just haven't heard or seen or experienced things that make me have this kind of abiding deep respect that apparently everybody has for The Undertaker, so it's not like I'm the only one. But part of that is because he is very old school, and I'm an old school guy too, so as far as what I like, and so I appreciate that the Taker sort of carries on that thing where he's the leader in the back, you know, he's usually the judge in their court, you know, wrestler court, and he, you know, and I have a friend that's been on the show before, Ray Garner, and he's a huge Taker fan too, and he's younger than me, and so, you know, it's even more important to him because, like you guys, he was, you know, more of a new thing to them, you know, a character when coming out in their youth, you know, so it has more resonance, and so on and so forth. So we've talked several times, just the last 2 years, everybody says, well, is this it for The Undertaker? Is this it for The Undertaker? You know, or whatever. And he just always, his scenarios always had The Undertaker winning. And I said, that's not going to happen, Ray. And he goes, why? I said, he's too old school. The Undertaker, more than anybody in this business right now, even over some old timers, is totally old school. The Undertaker's going out on his back. I mean, I don't know the man personally, but I know him. I truly believe that there was no way in the world that he wasn't going to go out putting somebody over. It's important as to who he would put over. And it's no surprise to me that he put over the guy that Vince thinks is the future of his company, because Undertaker is a company guy. Yeah. I think that it was a terrible match in a way. It was not as horrible as some people make it out to be, considering the fact that Undertaker should not even have been in there.
Yeah.
And he was just well past his prime. He was too old. And Roman's not the kind of guy that could carry the Undertaker like maybe somebody else could. I mean, not a knock on Roman, because I think Roman's a lot better than people give him credit for. He wasn't able to and of course the most famous bit, which where he was trying to do the tombstone, and he couldn't get him up, and because Taker couldn't help him, and so forth. But all of that falls away with that ending. You know, all of it falls away when Taker stands in that ring and the fans are there, 75,000 plus whatever, and they start showing their appreciation for him. And he takes off his gear and he leaves it in the ring. Another old school thing, totally old school. And then, you know, he walks slowly back to his, you know, ramp, the elevator, and puts his fist up. I mean, that is a WrestleMania moment. And it'll be a moment, one of the greatest, maybe the greatest, that we've ever seen, because he did it his way. He did it the way that I knew that he was going to do it. And it was even better than I imagined it. So, I mean, I
think that they were very smart in making that match not about the match, not about hitting the spots and everything so much as making it about the story, you know, making it about this. I heard Steve Austin do a podcast not too long ago regarding WrestleMania, and he mentioned the Undertaker is like an old gunslinger. And I think that's a perfect analogy.
Yes.
You know, in this story that you have this tired old gunslinger that's come out, who's not going to go down easy, but let's all face it, he can't physically do it anymore. And that's, I think there's a lot of respect, that in the way that Roman showed, like he keeps putting him down, but going, golly day, he won't stay down. I don't want to do this. I don't want to be the one to have to take this legend down. And I think that the way that Undertaker left it, where it was just simply him taking off the gloves, taking off the jacket, taking off the hat, and leaving the end of the ring, was the perfect type of ending for it. Basically, him acknowledging, I can't do this anymore.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it's time for me to walk with pride out in the sunset, acknowledge the career that I had, appreciate the career that I've had, but knowing that, you know, I ain't stupid either.
Yeah,
well, this is a young man's game.
There's only one way to go out.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, and I thought it was for well
him,
done.
You know, there's only one way to go out, and that is losing. You know,
yeah.
He's not going to just retire, just, you know, say, okay, that's it, I quit. It's got to be in a situation like this. And I know that Taker booked that match or at least partially did. In the fact, because it just so fits what I knew that he would want to go out.
Well, and like you were saying, too, with him being a company man, of all the people that Roman Reigns could fight in hopes to get him over, which he's still not over with the crowd, you know, it's Undertaker. But then it's like, God, he wrestled the Undertaker, he beat the Undertaker, and he's still not over the crowd. What is it going to take for Roman? But that's another conversation in and of itself.
And when
but
that
I think that's that was the perfect person for Taker to fight. For Roman to fight.
I mean,
I would have liked to have seen somebody different personally as his last match.
Sure. You know, and that's obviously what the deal is here, is that the negative on it is that the WWE picked a guy that a lot of people didn't want to see do it. But from the WWE's perspective and from Undertaker's perspective, it was the perfect choice.
Yeah. If he can't do it, who can?
Exactly. Right. It's got to be Roman. And yep. So in that regard, and also, you know, I think, well, and I was going to say that the reason the match resonated for me, it maybe not be the technical marvel or the slugfest, whatever, but it wasn't horrible, and the story was great, like you just pointed out. And the story was also reminiscent of the Ric Flair retirement match and the Shawn Michaels retirement match. It wasn't exactly the same, but it had just the same kind of notes, where, you know, the old-timer just can't get it done, but it's going down fighting. And,
right.
And that's perfect for The Undertaker. And the great ending, and so on and so forth. And also, I think it was Richard that said on the WrestleMania show that he thought, and I agree with him, if it was definitely him that said it, that actually the botch there with the tombstone actually added a hint of realism to the whole thing.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, that just shows he wants to get it done. I mean, he can. I mean, good Lord, he's what, 52? Is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my goodness. His body has been beaten to death for 25 years. I will say this, though. I really wish that this WrestleMania match would have been the one that, like, the one that he lost, not the one to Brock Lesnar. I still don't.
Oh, yeah. No,
I can't agree with that decision to. Yeah. I don't understand what purpose that having him lose at that WrestleMania served. Brock was over to begin with.
Yeah, you know, that's a big question mark in a lot of people's eyes. And a lot of people speculate, you know, there's a lot of speculation, but it could have been a situation where he really did think that that was going to be Undertaker's last match.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that makes any logical sense to me, is that was going to be it. And then he didn't. So, you know, it's one of those things. It's kind of like, and this one is true, and that's all speculation. But we know for a fact that when Mick Foley hung it up during the Attitude Era, he immediately come back very shortly after that in that four-way match, you know. And that was one of the biggest regrets in Mick's career, according to him, was because it just took away all of that special thing when he was retired, because it was so quick and so soon it didn't mean anything anymore. And
right.
So, you know, but that was, again, was them. They had to have him because somebody was injured and
right.
Company guy too, you know, in a way.
Well, guys, hey, continue this conversation. I've actually got my boss on the phone needing me to give him some technical information for work. So, but I will be right back. So carry on. I'm going to step out for just a second.
All right, fine, Connor. Thank you. So,
I don't mind the fact that Roman beat Undertaker and that was his last match or whatever. But in my mind, I always wanted Kane and Undertaker, like, that to be both of their last matches.
That would have been
storyline-wise, like, just, you know, more for the fans. I mean, it wouldn't have been an inside thing or anything, but, like, you know, and it's definitely not really the old school way that Taker probably would have wanted to go out, but I just think storyline-wise, you know, just because I don't even know if we'll get a last match with Kane at this point.
I don't know, especially if he gets elected. So.
I mean, yeah, and I can't imagine that he's not going to. So, if anybody didn't know, he's running for mayor in Knoxville, which is basically where I live.
But so, you can't, you live like right outside of it, right? So you wouldn't be able to vote for him?
Correct.
Oh.
Correct, yeah. But I do see his campaigns all over the place. So, I mean, I'm about 20 minutes from Knoxville. So.
Right.
But, yeah, so, I just think...
I don't know why I never remember that, but one day we need to do a Smoky Mountain show.
We will eventually, yes. Yeah. I want to do a little bit more research and find some people from around here, and
which that's another reason for you to listen to Cornette's podcast. That comes up a bit, obviously. True.
And a lot of, I mean, you know, I've watched a few episodes of Smoky Mountain on the network, but I mean, I was raised around it too. I mean, I didn't catch it every week or anything, but I definitely saw it around. But yeah, I just.
Now, by the way, the Undertaker wrestled at Smoky Mountain.
Oh yeah, so did Kane. Mm-hmm. Most Garner. Everybody. I mean, Smoky Mountain was not a small federation. I mean, it was at the time, but when you look at it, my gosh, the talent they had was insane. I mean, Chris Jericho and Lance Storm basically started there.
Al Snow.
Snow. So there's a. There is a lot of history that goes Sunny. With Smokey. Yeah, Sonny. I mean, you had T.L. Hopper, better known as Dirty White Boy.
Dirty White Boy.
So, and the Dirty White Girl.
And the Dirty White Girl.
Which we mentioned on the show before.
I like Dirty White Girls.
Yeah.
That's racist.
But, yeah, I don't you know, that. Do y'all remember that they, y'all remember the, it's kind of, I mean, Bray really has more connection with Undertaker than we think in a way, because as much as Bray, you know, Sister Abigail is supposedly a real thing and is going to be possibly his real life sister, or may eventually be brought in and somebody else, but the character of Sister Abigail is supposed to make an appearance at some point. That apparently is what I've heard is the plan. But Undertaker and Kane had a similar thing. There was a sister that was going to be introduced.
That's
they
right.
never, they never really like mentioned right. it, but like that, it was a it was a consideration.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I don't
that.
Know why they didn't. I mean, it was probably the fact that they didn't have anybody. Or I mean, the time I actually like the Ministry of Darkness, and I actually like the that section of the Undertaker's career. But I know a lot of people didn't. But I thought it fit that era.
I don't want to fight between you and Connor.
Me, Carson.
Carson.
And
sorry, Connor. Carson.
So, but. I think the sister would have been good in that time frame, you know.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, he had the whole group.
Yes.
Know. Yeah.
And then you had, it was me, Austin.
Right, yes. I think that's probably, that's usually really the reason why people have a real big problem with it. And, of course, the big controversy over the crucifixion thing.
Sure.
And so, you know, they pushed the envelope a little bit, you know. It's, I didn't hate it, but it wasn't my favorite Undertaker thing ever, you know. So
what was your favorite Undertaker thing?
Probably it's a good question. I think he ladder run. He seasoned into just this incredible in-ring performer. He still had all the trappings, he still had the presence. But that run with you know, his match, you know, his match against Flair was great. But Edge, and the two Shawn Michaels matches, and then the two Triple H matches, and a couple for, you know, Edge. He had a really great run there, where unlike what Richard said earlier, where he kind of was behind the eight ball originally, there was a period there where he was having the best match on the freaking card in many cases.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was probably, that's got to be my favorite run for Undertaker. Yeah.
The Edge one was really good because at the time, Edge was also undefeated at WrestleMania. So
That's right.
That added to it.
And they stacked the deck because they had the Edge heads and of course, Guerrero, Vicky.
Yeah.
And it just looked like the stack was so that they actually created a doubt in people's minds that the Undertaker may not win because he has all this stacked against him. But, of course, eventually he did persevere.
And his match with Mark Henry, I thought, was really good.
I think the Mark Henry match was very good. I don't think, again, it was kind of like this match, you know, with Brock and Goldberg. And people didn't really expect much out of it. And they thought it was going to be, you know, not very good. But it was great. I thought it was fine. Yeah.
What about you, Richard? What was your favorite Undertaker moment or run or whatever?
It was probably my favorite, like, match, and like, it was. I was a pretty big Kane fan, so this is kind of where it's going. But
here we go again.
It was actually the first Hell in the Cell, and it was the fact that that was his match. It was Undertaker versus Shawn Michaels,
mm-hmm.
and the debut of Kane. I thought that was a really good match outside of Kane debuting, but I just think that storyline was great, and just the, you know, the secrecy behind it, and just the way everything was introduced, and it had a background, and, you know, it was just, I thought it was well written product. But the 4 years, the two Shawn Michaels matches and the two Triple H matches at WrestleMania, man, those were just, I think that's why we look down, maybe not look down is the right, but, you know, over the past, you know, 4 years or so, his matches haven't been as special because those were just so good.
Yeah.
And not so much the wrestling, which the wrestling was great, but just
the story.
The story. The, both Shawn Michaels and Triple H, old school guys, along with Undertaker, and they meticulously just crafted those matches. And they were just flawless.
Well, you know, that and that usually is what I use as an example when I, you know, talk to people. Like, there's this, my Ray's got this girlfriend who is a wrestling fan, but she's not very inside. She doesn't know a lot of stuff. So, you know, we kind of help her learn and so on and so forth. And I was using that those matches as an example of what the difference between work and work rate is. Because Sean can work rate with the best of them. And Undertaker, for his size, certainly can too. But their matches aren't all about work rate. Their matches are a work, and they're great workers. I guess they tell a story, the psychology. The everything has a meaning. Everything has a purpose. Until you're totally sucked into the match, you're sucked into the moment, you're sucked into the ending, and then they totally deliver for you, and that's the reason why those matches stand the test of time. There's an art, there's an artistry to it, and those guys were freaking Rembrandts that night.
I'm back, gentlemen.
Hey, there he is.
So Carson, Jonathan asked the question of what our favorite moments were, and me and John already gave our answer. So what's maybe your favorite run or match with Undertaker?
Undertaker? Oh, well, it may not be his best as far as his performance, but as far as memorable, for me, it's got to be Hell in a Cell with Mick Foley.
Well, there you go.
And that's what I think is interesting is, like, I think Undertaker is especially old school because, like, anytime we mention him, we're mentioning the other person as much because he did as much to put them over as himself.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
There's no freaking way that Kane would have had any kind of career if Undertaker hadn't have.
That's right.
Evaded that. I mean,
that's right.
The Undertaker sold for Kane. He you know, Kane became a true presence and something that we believed was a threat to the Undertaker, and that was helped by Undertaker and by Paul Bearer, and then Kane went on and become, you know, his own legend. And that's another thing. I mean, what you're talking about, I mean, because you have Mick and Kane up a lot, but there's a reason, because there's just this, since he was introduced, there is this overlapping between the two characters where they feud with each other, they tag with each other. And I understand where you and Ray Garner, because he agreed with you that he would love to see, and I think there's a lot of people that think that way. And I wouldn't be against it. I would be just as marked out about it either if the last match would have been Kane and Undertaker. I just knew that that was never going to happen. But,
you know, I think probably what makes the Undertaker Mankind Hell in a Cell match such a memorable thing for me is not only obviously seeing it, which is pretty amazing, but the story behind that story. After reading Mick Foley's book, the first book that he had written, he talks about that match in quite a bit of length. And one of the things he talks about is how both he and Undertaker were, I mean, kind of beat up and injured before the match even began. You know, Taker was dealing with a knee injury, and they were all talking about, like, hey, what are we going to do to, we're going to stink this place up if we just go out there and just, you know, we got to do something to really start the match off. And that's where Mick Foley's like, just throw me off the top. But all the things that they planned and all the things they didn't plan on that match and how they just kept going was amazing showmanship, and definitely points to the professional working ethic that Taker had. I mean, especially like Foley was talking about how that choke slam he got on the top of the cell was the best and the worst he'd ever had in his life. He's like, it's the worst because he didn't get any height. You know, it looked pretty ugly, but if Taker would have done that any other way, it could have killed him.
Right. Oh, it was a fair, small margin. But here's the deal. Because, you know, not taking anything away from Mick in this, because Mick put it all on the line there. Very dangerously so. But part of what made it work is that, given the situations that totally did not go on script, and were, you know, very... Everybody always thinks about the table, but that was a planned spot. Going through the freaking top, that's what could have killed it.
Yeah, yeah.
And Taker didn't sell it at all. He didn't sell it at all.
Yeah.
Because he was afraid.
That takes incredible... Yeah, I mean, because that takes incredible self-control. Because this isn't somebody, this is Mick Foley. He knows this guy. It's a friend of his. Guy that he's wrestled with quite a bit. And he doesn't know if that guy's dead or not.
You know, the funny thing is about his character, though, he didn't have to sell it. He was just being calm, cool, and collected, which were like, oh, that's the Undertaker.
Yeah, exactly.
But he just had to be himself.
That's a moment where a normal human being would not call. It was like, oh, shit. I killed Mick Foley. Oh, my God. and then maybe there was that little bit going on inside, you know. It's interesting because we were just, me and Richard were talking about, we're big fans of the Bruce Pritchard podcast, which I recommend everybody out there listen to ours first and then go and listen to Bruce Pritchard. It's just hilarious.
Is that any relation to Tom Pritchard by chance?
He is. He's the brother of Tom Pritchard, yeah. He played Brother Love, Bruce Pritchard did.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he was a behind-the-scenes guy for years.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I used to work with Tom Pritchard at NWA Rocky Top in Knoxville.
Oh, cool.
I edited all of the television shows that we had on WMAK Channel 7, did all the promos and stuff.
Just consider yourself rebooked, and we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
make yourself ready and
I'll give you some good behind the scenes stuff.
Good. That's a done deal. That's a future show. So anyway, getting back to this, Brucey and Tom both, of course, grew up in Houston and became part of the Houston. I mean, as little kids, they were sitting there, you know, helping Paul Bosch, you know, and selling posters and helping, you know, gophers. And then Tom trained to be a wrestler, and Bruce became an office guy. And then he went on to, and then eventually went to WWF, and he became Brother Love, but he also was still an office guy. And he was a major, major part of the higher powers to be for years at WWE, for years. But he talks, and that's why the show is great, because he knows so much about the inner workings of WWE for some of the greatest periods of WWE history. And his host kind of just needles him and gets it out of him. But he's also a great mimic, and he mimics a lot of people. But
he wore makeup, didn't he?
Oh, it's Paul Bearer. I mean, no, it's Brother Love.
It's Brother Love.
Yeah, he was like...
No, he just had a really tight collar.
I thought for sure even as a kid, I was like, this guy's got to be wearing makeup. Otherwise, I'm going to see this guy stroke out at any second.
Yes. Yeah, he was. I wish Brother Love would have lasted longer, because it was brilliant. But he decided he didn't want to go on the road. So anyway. What was I getting? Bruce mentioned on the show something that was relating to what we were talking about all the way outside. I've forgotten.
He recently did an episode of The Undertaker, and he just knows a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff about The Undertaker.
Well, that wasn't what I was talking about. It was on the Q&A, and somebody brought up something that was related to something we were just talking about, and I've completely spaced it. All right. So anyway, your turn, Jonathan. What?
Well, I was, I was immediately intrigued by The Undertaker. I don't, I watched a lot of WCW, but I honestly don't remember seeing Mean Mark Callis. I'm sure I did at some point, but, you know, his time there was kind of fleeting. It was like less than a year, I think. So, my first memories are when he debuted for the WWF, and specifically... his feud with the Ultimate Warrior is what really got me interested, because they were both probably there about the same amount of time, and they both came in obviously very, you know, one was very high energy and colorful, and the other one was quite the opposite of that, but they had very similar trajectories of being unstoppable, basically. And then they, you know, he attacked the Ultimate Warrior on the funeral parlor and locked him in the casket. And that was still to this day is one of the most memorable moments of wrestling that I've ever seen. And, you know, because, you know, the Ultimate Warrior's trapped in there. And then the commentators are talking about how at this point, like, there's no way he's not dead, basically. And then they finally get the thing open, and there's all those claw marks, and the Ultimate Warrior's not there. And then, you know, leading up to that, The Undertaker had been doing this thing where he put people in body bags whenever he defeated them. So they had that match where the Ultimate Warrior actually beat him and put him in a body bag. And then there was the whole thing with Undertaker and Jake the Snake and the Macho Man's wedding. And eventually all of this led up to The Undertaker defeating Hulk Hogan for the WWF title. That entire run, that might be three different runs, but to me, it was all one. Yeah, it was all one big thing to me. You know, I think that was before the Ultimate Warrior and Hulk Hogan had their WrestleMania match, right?
Yeah.
I think so.
So even before the Ultimate Warrior, you know, the whole intrigue behind that match to me was, again, like Hulk Hogan seemed like you just couldn't beat him, but so did the Ultimate Warrior, but the Undertaker had already beaten him. And I think there was some controversy there. I don't remember exactly how that all went down, but, you know, the Undertaker defeated Hulk Hogan and was a WWF champion. So that was my favorite portion of his career. And I did like in the Attitude Era when it went a little more like satanic and got a little edgier. I wasn't a huge fan of the biker thing, but I didn't really see it as a huge departure, because I could see, you know, people that are into that lifestyle often are also into just, obviously, you know, the Western mortician guy versus the biker is very different, but he had kind of evolved a little bit to be a more realistic version of that.
Yeah.
So
actually I do like the big evil version of that than I do when he was a face with it. I was more into that. Yeah. Yeah. When he started calling himself Big Evil and he was heel and all that, the other, I was really digging that quite a bit. And again, I don't want to say I did like the ministry thing. I just think it was booked terribly in too many places where it just didn't mesh as well as some of the other stuff back then. So it has a couple of really bad memories with it. But overall, I had no problem with the concept. I thought it was pretty cool, and him having his own, you know, group and everything else, I thought was a good idea.
Yeah. And I always preferred him as a heel just because I thought the character lent itself to that. It's the same way Bray Wyatt does, but then also the same way Bray Wyatt is over with the fans now. You know, you just, when someone's good at what they're doing, eventually people start to cheer for it despite the heinous acts that person is committing or whatever.
That's right. I mean my favorite wrestler of all time is Roddy Piper. We've said this many times on the show before. And whenever invariably people start talking about greatest heels of all time, or, you know, whether it's other wrestlers or whether it's WWE list shows or us on the podcast or other people on the podcast, they invariably mention Roddy. And that's because Roddy was a great heel, and he was one of the greatest heels of all time. But he was so damn good that he became a face, and he couldn't be a heel anymore. And so he actually, most of his career, he was a face. You know, so most of for like the last 25 years of his career, he was always a face. So, it's kind of a weird dichotomy, but you're right. And that's what happens. Yeah, Ric Flair can't be a heel anymore.
You know? Right.
It happens. So, but yeah, so, so we're pretty close to wrapping up here.
Well, one thing I would like to point out is that I haven't seen this week's Raw and SmackDown, but so far they're saying that basically it appears as if that was his last match. And I think it probably was, but they haven't come out and said that was Undertaker's last match yet. So, you know, maybe there is one more or something. You never know.
Well, I do know that Ray Garner, his dream is for his last match to be at Survivor Series. Because that was his debut.
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate, but at the same time, WrestleMania, like you said at the beginning of the show, he has become synonymous with WrestleMania.
He has.
So, and Survivor Series is not even what it was. You know, there isn't even a Survivor Series match. I guess there has been in recent years, but they got away from that for a while. So,
yeah.
But that would be a good way. He could be the surprise member of somebody's team again, and that would be a good way to go out. Especially,
I would be very surprised though, because the way he ended that match at the end of that show, to me it looked like he left Undertaker in the ring. Now, maybe he comes and does one last match as Mark Calloway.
Well, one thing that's
maybe he teams with Kane. You know,
one thing you can always expect is the unexpected when it comes to the WWE. They're always going to make some crazy, you know, never say never, right? So, but here's the thing though, if they have him do another match, whether that be a WrestleMania or Survivor Series, it just dilutes everything that just happened. It doesn't make it near as meaningful. Like him putting down the coat and the hat, it just dilutes it. You know, it doesn't make it as strong as I agree.
And I think that actually exactly what Jonathan said is the whole point of it. I think that Taker wants him to, just like you said earlier, Carson, when you'll basically slip off into the night, you know.
Yes.
And that's it. You don't talk about it
in
no
mystery.
More. You don't see him no more. It's a mystery. I mean, will he come back? Will he ever come back? But he just never comes back, you know.
Right.
And unlike others, it's not this, because he's never has been the character that has had that kind of same kind of thing as some of the characters, where he's like, well, yes, such and such, you know, when you talk about his career and you talk about, well, he's always been this sort of force that kind of inserted himself into the situations for the most part, rather than being booked or being one of the boys or being a ratchet. Right. So,
I mean, he appeared in a mysterious fashion. He lived his entire career in that shroud of mystery. He should leave in that same shroud.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times did he lose a buried alive match or something like that, and people thought that was the last time you
right.
Oh, yeah,
that
right.
was in the 90s or early 2000s.
Well, and that's the thing. He had three matches based around him, you know, Hell in the Cell, Buried Alive, Casket Match. Casket match, and actually a fourth one with the Inferno match. Maybe not all specifically created by him or for him, but yeah, if you mention those matches, people will say The Undertaker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And the body bag thing was basically just a precursor to the casket match.
Casket match, right. Yeah. Yes.
I don't want to end the show without mentioning Paul Bearer and how important he was to The Undertaker's character.
For sure.
The Undertaker was good without him, but just the Paul Bearer
establishing him, it wouldn't have happened without Paul Bearer.
Yeah, because Undertaker didn't talk for a long time.
No.
I mean, really.
It's the exact same thing that's happening right now with Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it happened with Kane as well, you know. I mean, Kane never spoke at all either.
That's what
and
I said earlier. I said Paul was helpful for that, too.
He's the mouthpiece, so, and just maybe not, I mean, I think Heyman is a better mouthpiece, but Paul Bearer was certainly unique.
Well, Percy was a great talker,
sure.
But then Paul's what he is, but he wasn't being Percy, he was being Paul Bearer. And that character lent itself to, it was more what and who he was and how he presented himself than necessarily great promos in particular themselves. Mm-hmm. It was all creating this mood and this atmosphere and this character And he nailed that, and so did The Undertaker, and that's what got into, you know, everybody's minds and imaginations, and it just caught on fire.
Even as a kid, I didn't really realize this, but now as an adult, I feel like he was just like a tribute to the old late night horror hosts.
Oh, like, yeah.
That character. Absolutely, like, yes. Like it was, that's yes. probably where he got inspiration from.
Yes. Hey, do you think he wore makeup?
Just a little bit.
So just now realize that the only real two managers he's ever had were wearing like really thick completely opposite. One super tan, the other one very pale. But
I don't know if these I remember a time when I think it was USWA would come on ESPN in the afternoons, and I'd watch it when I got home from school. And there was a time where Percy Pringle was on there, and right. Paul Bearer was on WWF. And I don't know if it was just like some of it was pre-recorded.
It was pre-recorded material before he had left, and by that time he had already started as Paul Bearer. So yeah, there's a little cross-pollination there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I always thought, you know, they clearly were the same person.
Yes.
But, you know, it was kind of like yin and yang of the same person or something like that.
A very quick little point about that. We almost didn't get Paul Bearer in that regard because Rick Rude wanted him to come to WCW with him. He decided he didn't because he had it pretty good there in Texas working with the office and working is Percy, and he had kind of gotten tired of Rick's kind of on the road type of behavior. They were still friends, but he just didn't want to deal with it anymore. So he told Rick he's going to stick there. So who knows what might have happened if he would have went to WCW? He might have stayed there and might have took off there, you know, or did other stuff. So, you know, it's kind of interesting how sometimes these roads converge and so on and so forth. But the perfect storm happened, and all. Percy did go gumball and joined up with The Undertaker and created one of the greatest things in WWE history. And that's going to wrap it up. Jonathan, did you have something just talk about? Some news or some kind of...
Well, I just wanted to mention, you know, a few episodes ago, Richard and I kind of recapped the Ring of Honor TV tapings that we both attended here in Atlanta, and they're coming back soon, so maybe we can do that again. But there was a dark match that we talked about that Ring of Honor posted a week or maybe 2 weeks. I think it was last week sometime, so it shouldn't be too hard to find on their social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, whatever. That match is online, basically. So, you know, of course, all four TV taping episodes that were recorded that night have aired. But if you want to see that match, which features Raphael King, I believe John Skyler, who is gone. Did he win the top prospect tournament? I haven't seen. I know he was one of the finalists. Seen it.
I know. Yeah.
Matt Sexcells and.
I know that guy.
Yeah. I'm forgetting who the fourth person is at the moment.
I think
anyway.
Forgot the fourth person last time as well.
That poor first, fourth person.
Well, those three have Atlanta connections of sort, and I think the fourth guy maybe didn't, and that's why I keep forgetting him.
Burners.
Anyway, it's on all their social media outlets, and if you follow Matt Sells on Facebook and whatnot, he shared it a lot. So it's out there. It's a great match. And just wanted to let people know that they could see it now.
All right, then. Well, I guess then we will close it off. And I think all that's left is for each one of us to give a hearty thank you, Taker.
Thank you, Taker.
Thanks,
is that hardy Dave. Enough? I don't know.
That's hard. That's pretty hard.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace.
Even though he didn't die.
No. Well, Taker did.
true.
All right. Well, thank you, folks, and we will see you next time. And thank you once again for listening. And share your favorite matches or eras or everything, memories, personal memories of The Undertaker on the Facebook page for Pro Wrestling Roundtable. And, of course, with our social media and so on and so forth, which Richard can give you all that information. And for now, good night. Let me get my follow up here. It took place. Oh, come on, internet.
I'm leaving this in. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, go ahead. I don't care. Show how the sausage is made.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.